So, wir fangen dann mit der Langevin-Gleichung an, oder Langevin-Equation. And this is a Newton's equation in the presence of some noise. So we have Newton's law, the acceleration, so the change in momenta equals, now I, this friction, the general friction term. Now instead of just having a normal gamma, I have here normalized with the m so that in the end it goes away, but really doesn't matter, plus a noise term, which I'm now going to do. So at the moment we have no normal force, only damping. Proportional to gamma, larger than zero, and the noise term. So what is the noise term? That is a force, obviously, because it's here on the right-hand side of Newton's equation, and it's random. So at every time point, it's random. So that means if you would discretize time in a very small interval, the noise can be anything. So completely independent. Now, since time is continuous, it's difficult to draw the noise since it's completely random. And it is denoted white noise if there's really absolutely no correlation. That means that psi of t, psi of zero, the expectation value, that means the ensemble average over all noise realizations, or we can also put here t and t prime, is a delta function with some prefactor delta t minus t prime. So as you remember, these are the correlation functions, so that means the noise at a certain time t has no correlation whatsoever with the noise at a different time. So they're completely independent random variables. It could also be differently, and that is then denoted, we are not considering that here, colored noise, if we still have noise, it's a random process, but the correlation function is not a delta function, but something, some f of t minus t prime. And why these two names, colored and white noise? Because if you take the Fourier transform of a delta function, e to the I t omega delta of t dt, then we know that the Fourier transform is independent of omega, is flat. So we know that in frequency space we have something completely flat. If in time space we have something very peaky, and the other way around. White light. Light is white if all frequencies are there. That's why it's denoted white noise. All frequencies are there. And colored noise is if the frequency in frequency space, you have a color. If the distribution of frequency is not uniform, and then of course in time space, you have also something more complicated. That is the naming, white noise, very peaky. So in the extreme case is a delta function in time domain, completely flat in frequency domain. And white noise is a noise which is considered really in most of the cases. And that is because it's, of course, much easier to then deal mathematically with delta function than with something else. But in nature, of course, this might not really be a good consideration of noise. Normally, you might have a random process which is now however continuous, and if it's continuous, it can never be white noise. It can be random over some time scale, but you may have a certain autocorrelation function until you really a randomness sets in. So white noise is always some approximation to really processes. So how do we see that physically? So in physics, we consider a particle in some liquid, for example, and then we have many molecules around these particles, and these molecules might collide with this particle, giving it a kick, and this collision is then phenomenologically described by a noise term, like seeing a random force. So it's a phenomenological description of some processes which you don't control, look pretty random, and then you have a random noise. So the noise term normally might have a mean, but normally has no mean, because otherwise we can consider the mean as a constant force. So in most of the cases, we will consider that the mean of the noise equals zero. If that is not the case, well, we would just consider the constant part of the noise as a force and not as a noise term. So the mean of the noise is generally considered to be zero, and that is the reason why we can consider this here as an autocorrelation function, because we don't have to subtract the mean, because the mean is generically zero. Otherwise, it's just a constant term which we can take out of the noise term. So that is a Langevin equation. So a very simple equation. Later on, we will generalize that and add a potential there. So a potential. So normally in Newton's equation, it's minus the gradient of some potential. We will add that later on. But at the moment, we will just consider damping and noise. Now, the noise term is stochastic. That is why it's called a stochastic equation. And all equations, dynamic equations, which have a noise term, is part of stochastic physics. And so what is the, if you look at that phenomenologically, let's say we have another external potential, or really not so important, then the friction term will always try to bring you to the rest. And the noise term is a random term which can kick you in any direction. So you don't want to be at rest, but also maybe you don't always want to go into the same direction, because where you are going to kick in which direction is random. But in a certain sense, noise and friction are counteracting each other. Not very systematically, of course, noise, but to a certain extent. And we are considering here the dynamics which are driven by the noise. And the strength of the noise is Q. Q is the strength of the noise, because it gives us the correlation function. So it's a measure of the strength of the noise. Which is pretty clear, because if Q equals zero, there's no noise at all. So we solve the Langevin equation formally. A formal integration. So the velocity is a function of time t equals v0 e to the minus gamma t. That is coming from the here, and that is the reason why we have here an m and m, so that this cancels away. Plus e to the minus gamma t over m integral from 0 to t dt prime e to the gamma t prime psi of t prime. That is the formal solution. How do you see that? Well, just by simply differentiating. So v dot, what is v dot? V dot is minus gamma v's. Well, I can take the derivative here and here. So then I have a minus gamma v of t. Because if I take the derivative here and here, I can take it out. Plus e to the minus gamma t over m, taking the derivative here, e to the gamma t psi of t. And we see that this is exactly this equation. I can multiply by m, and then have exactly the Langevin equation. So what is the mean velocity? So if I take the average velocity over all average over all ensemble fluctuation of noises, so of all realization of noise, well, the first term is not is independent of noise, so that is v0 e to the minus gamma t. Plus e to the minus gamma t over m from 0 to t, e t prime, e to the gamma t prime, and the ensemble average over the noise. Now the ensemble average over the noise is 0 per definition. So this vanishes. This term vanishes since this term is 0. And so this is then in the limit t going to infinity. This is 0 since this is also exponentially damped since this is a friction term. So you might think, oh, that is really a boring equation. Nothing happens. Velocity goes to 0. But that's not really true, since this is a mean velocity, remains zero. But nevertheless, quite a few of things happening. And we are calculating v squared of t. So the mean squared velocity. And that is not zero. So what is that? So I just take the square of the formal solution. And then I have the first term squared, v0 squared, e to the minus 2 gamma t. There's no noise there, so that is fine. Plus, and now I take both of them, 2v0 e to the minus gamma t over m, integral from 0 to t, dt prime, e to the gamma t prime, ensemble average over psi of t prime. And then I have the second term squared, which is then e to the minus 2 gamma t over m squared, integral from 0 to t, dt prime, integral from 0 to t, dt double prime, e to the gamma t prime, e to the gamma t double prime, and psi of t prime, psi of t double prime, ensemble average. And since these are both, of course, noise terms, this is again zero. This goes to zero in the thermodynamic for long times. So for long times, only the last term survives. And this term here is, of course, nothing else than q times delta t prime minus t double prime. So I can integrate, for example, over t prime. If I integrate over t prime, I find that t prime and t double prime are the same. So I find that this is nothing else. E squared p equals, okay, this is the first term which is going to vanish, plus q e to the minus 2 gamma t over m squared, integral from 0 to t dt prime e to the 2 gamma t prime, because that is I of the delta function. This one is, of course, easy integral. It is 1 over 2 gamma prime e to the 2 gamma t minus 1 divided by 2 gamma, just the integral. And so that means if I'm taking the limit t going to infinity, then we have the ensemble average v squared over t goes to, for t going to infinity, this first term vanishes, and in the second term I have this damping term minus 1 that is vanishing. These ones cancel each other, so we have that this is q divided by 2 gamma m squared. So that is finite. That means we have a movement, a trajectory, which on the mean has no velocity, but it has a finite variance. So the velocity distribution function is something like that. The mean velocity is 0, but it has a finite variance, r sigma, which is the square root of. So the particle moves forth and back, but on the average, the velocity is 0. And now the issue is, does it go away at all? Does it always stay in the same place? And has it something to do with diffusion? So in order to examine that, we have now to calculate from the Lange equation not the velocity as a function of time, but the position as a function of time, or better said, the correlation function of x squared. Because if we want to compare with diffusion, the quantity we want to calculate is the ensemble average of x squared. And this is also readily done. So our aim is to calculate x squared of t. In order to do that, we calculate a few other quantities, and it's a little bit, it's really simple, but it's an indirect way, because we have this solution. The Lange equation is not directly formulated in x. So the first thing we do is we multiply the Lange equation with x on both sides, minus gamma vx plus xi x over m. And I'm divided by m. And so I can take the ensemble average of that. So if I take the ensemble average, I find, I have to calculate that, of course, this one is minus gamma vx plus 1 over m xi x. So I have to calculate these three quantities and see what they are. I do it in the following way. I notice that, let's say first take here, v times x is nothing else than x, x dot, nothing else than d by dt x squared over 2. And that means I can substitute this ensemble average by this ensemble average in the time derivative. The other quantity I have, x, x, v dot, that is, of course, x, 2 dot, and that is the same here, d by dt squared, sorry, x squared half minus x dot squared. Because if I take the second derivative of this one, of course I get x dot squared, which I have to take the derivative, and I get I can take first x dot and then x dot, and if I take the derivative of x dot, I can take this term. And the last term is xi ensemble average, that is here nothing else than x and xi, since these are independent and that is 0. So what I have here is that d by dt by dt squared, takes this left-hand side, x squared half minus v squared, because this is v squared, equals minus gamma 1/2 d by dt expectation value of x squared. And so I can take, this is a differential equation. I can put that a little bit differently in the following way. D by dt squared of x squared plus gamma d by dt of x squared, the quantity I want to find, equals 2 v squared. And the key point is that this quantity we already calculated for long times, and that is nothing else than times this one, q divided by gamma m squared. So I have a differential equation for the quantity I would like to find. It's a simple differential equation which I can determine, and the right-hand side is a constant. It is, you can just make an exponential ansatz and you find, so to calculate the eigenvalues, and you find then x squared equals gamma t minus 1 plus e to the gamma t q divided by gamma cubed m squared. How do you see that? Well, again, just by taking the derivative, maybe just do it in a short while. I'm proving it immediately. But what we find is that in the limit t going to infinity, minus is here. Sorry, minus. Yeah. And the limit going to infinity, this term here is dominant. So this goes like q gamma squared m squared times t. And that means if we remember that this one is proportional to 2 times the diffusion constant times t for a normal diffusion process, we find that the diffusion constant is given by q 2 gamma squared m squared. That means the phenomenological diffusion constant of the diffusion equation has a justificational explanation in terms of microscopic variables. So diffusion is stronger the noise is, because diffusion is noise-driven. This diffusion is weaker if I have a large mass, because the particle has harder part, more difficult to move. And the diffusion is also weaker if the damping is large, because then, of course, the damping tries to put it in place. That is why the Langevin equation is a microscopic justification or description of diffusion processes. Just maybe the last, why this is solution. Well, it's really pretty simple. So if you take here x, the dot of this one, d by dt of x squared, then I have 2 terms, namely gamma minus gamma e to the minus gamma t times q gamma cubed over m squared. So this term here is only to make it 0 at time 0. So if x at time is 0, this cancels. These 2 particles cancels. So this is just that we start at 0. So this is nothing else than, well, if I take the second derivative, d by dt squared of x squared, then I get here a gamma squared e to the minus gamma t times q gamma cubed over m squared. And now, where's my equation? Here, if I take 1/2 of this one and I subtract this one, then I have one half. Not 1/2. I take this one and I subtract this one times gamma. So then I have this one here is e to the minus gamma t q gamma m squared plus gamma of this one. That is q gamma m squared 1 minus e to the minus gamma t. Then these exponential are canceling each other, and I have here the right-hand side. So that which proves that this is the solution of this one. So we can then go, as I said, another step forward into this consideration and add to the Langevin equation a Newton force driven by some potential gradient. And so then there are several regimes. So then we have just Newton equations in the presence of friction and in the presence of noise. Now, of course, if the noise term is a small variable, then really nothing important happens, you will go down the potential which you add, then some friction makes it everything slower until everything comes more or less to a still stand. But there are also cases, and we will consider that these cases, that the noise makes a qualitative difference to the dynamics. So that the dynamics is noise driven. Of course, that is often not the case, but we are considering here now the cases of noise controlled dynamics. Just in order to be aware that noise can, not necessarily, but can make a qualitative difference. So, and the first phenomena we are going to consider is what is denoted stochastic escape. So, our Langevin equation is now mv dot equals minus m gamma v, our friction term, plus now a force, which is dependent on the position, plus our noise term. As before, the only thing we added was an explicit force term, which is given from some gradient of a potential. So f of x is minus v prime of x, so just minus d by dx of some potential, a potential force. And the noise, as before, is white, xi of t, xi of t prime, ensemble average is some q delta of t minus t prime. And now we are considering several cases. the first case we will consider is first what happens when we have no noise, before we take everything together. So what happens if q equals zero? So if q equals zero, we know that from all our electric copper wires at home, that we will have a drift velocity by that. In a normal wire where you transport your electrical currents at home, you have an electric field inside, beziehungsweise on the outside of the wire. This electric field accelerates the electrons. These electrons bump against imperfections in the wire and against the phonons, which gives rise to friction, and they are accelerated until some steady state is reached where the friction and the acceleration by the electric field balance each other, and that phenomena you call drift. And how is the drift velocity defined? Well, the drift velocity is defined that the velocity doesn't change anymore. So in the steady state, v dot equals zero. We have no noise, so we don't need to take ensemble average. And so it means we have a balance. Zero equals minus m gamma v plus the force, if the force is a constant force, and there's a balance. So the drift velocity, which we call Vd for drift, is nothing given here by F divided by gamma m, if we have a constant part of the force. It's very trivial. And of course, the drift velocity is larger the stronger the force is, and smaller if you have large damping, or the mass is large. So from that, now we will need this drift velocity to derive what is denoted the Fokker-Planck equation. Namely, what we want to derive is, as before for the diffusion process, a master equation for rho or p, p of x and t, namely for the probability to find the diffusing or the stochastic particle at a certain position x in time t. So that is the probability distribution. For finding the particle position x at time t. Exactly like we did it for the diffusion process. And we want to this master equation in terms of as a differential equation, this term with differential operators, in this master equation is denoted the Fokker-Planck equation. And it's always derived by considering conserved quantities, namely the continuity equation. And the continuity equation tells us that the time derivative d by dt of p, or actually it's a partial, here I should be a little bit more careful, by x and t plus the real space derivative, so the gradient, let's say if we take it in 3D, j of x and t equals 0, or we will consider as a derivation in one dimension, then we have d by dt of p and x and t plus d by dx of j of x and t equals 0, where j of x and t is the current operator. Because the continuity equation is always valid if I have a conserved quantities. In this case, the conserved quantity is the number of particles. And the continuity equation always tells me that if I want to change the number of particles in a cubic test volume, I have only two possibilities. So I can change the density of particle, only one possibility, sorry. I can change the density of particles inside, which is here, the density of particles inside, only, so the total number, if I multiply with the test volume, only if I have a current going through the phases of this test volume, because they are conserved. So there's no other way around. And continuity equation always is exactly the same. Time derivative of the probability function plus the gradient of the current, the divergence of the current, sorry, is 0 if the number of particles is conserved. Of course, the problem is that we don't know how the current operator looks like. So we say, oh, we didn't really have made progress. We know we want to find that, and this equation will then be our Fokker-Planck equation, if we know what the current is. Now comes our physical intuition or understanding by saying we have two kinds of currents. We say we have one current. Contribution to the current is given by drift processes. Because if I have a drift, then of course this is corresponding to a particle transport, and the other one by random or diffusion processes. And why are they so fundamental? Because drift is ballistic, because I have a finite velocity, so particles are transported, are changing their position linearly in time, and the diffusion process, of course, is with square root in time. Of course, in principle, there could be other processes, but we will see that these two are sufficient. So what we say is that our current operator, we call this the xi from drift, j, sorry, current operator and j of xi. So that on the current operator, j equals jd plus j xi. And if you are able to have expressions separately for the drift contribution and for the diffusion contribution, then we can make sense out of the continuity equation. Now, that's not too difficult. For the drift contribution especially, it's not difficult because this is just a normal velocity. So this is just a very trivial transport of particle. Since I have an average finite velocity, if I have everything transporting, the transport of particles is trivial, just proportional to the velocity times the density of particles. So the number of particles transported, the current, so if you remind what the current is the number of particles passing some area per time. So you have current is, you have some area here. Then there's a number of particles passing this area divided by the area, of course. And so the number of particles per area per time passing. And if I have a finite velocity, then the number of particles passing is proportional to the velocity times the density of particles of the volume I'm transporting. We can also derive that if you like, but this is also done very often in physics. So I can just write down actually here the result. Gd, you could just Vt times the density or P of x and t. It's exactly the same for the electrical current. The electrical current is the velocity times the density of electrons. So it's exactly the same expression because the conservation is the same. Now, what about the diffusion currents? For that, in order to consider that, we have, as always, consider the equation of motion. If you remember from quantum mechanics how they derived in quantum mechanics, the current operator, which is something like in quantum mechanics, gradient of psi minus I gradient of psi star, something like that, with some prefactors, then you started with the Schrödinger equation. And you have rewritten the Schrödinger equation in terms of a continuity equation. And by doing that, you can read out the expression for the current operator in quantum mechanics. We do exactly the same here. We start with the diffusion equation, and we write the diffusion equation like a continuity equation. So the diffusion equation is d by dt of P of x and t equals d and the second derivative by dx, I do it in one dimension, P of x and t. And so I can just write it in the following way. That is P dot minus d by dx by j xi equals 0. If I write this one just as minus d by dx of R d by dx of p of x and t. And then you see, if I take this minus out on the other side, plus I have here for the continuity equation, and then my expression is that jx, j for xi from the diffusion process is minus d, d of p and x and t by dx. So the current is here proportional to the difference in the gradient in the density. If you remember that, probably you learned that many times, or often at least one time since in experimental or theoretical or wherever physics, the diffusion current is proportional to the gradient in particle density. Why is that? If you have lots of particles here and not so many particles here, then there will be particles diffusing from the left to the right. It's proportional to the gradient. And if you have no gradient in the particle densities, particles will move stochastically from the left and right, but the average current cancels out. And it's proportional to minus the gradient. Why proportional to minus the gradient? Because the gradients... The gradient goes up, and the current, of course, goes down. And it's proportional to the diffusion constant, since as stronger the diffusion is, the stronger the number of particles per time. So that makes all sense. So we can now put both of them together, and we have that the current operator is then the Vd p of x and t minus d d by dx of p of x and t. And we can also have them now in terms of microscopic quantities, f divided by gamma m p of x and t minus q of 2 gamma squared m squared d by dx of p of x and t. And the good point is, while this diffusion process we have derived when there is a constant constant force, but of course that is always the case. But on the local frame, if the potential is not really changing too much, we can still hold this argument and then have your general force or derivative of the gradient. And so generically, then we have the famous Fokker-Planck equation, which looks in the following, or exactly like we had it before, but which is then normally written like that, I dt equals minus, if you look at this one here, is then of course minus the gradient of the current, and the current is given by this one here. So it is minus d vd of p of x and t by dx. Why it's normally inside here, because the trip velocity doesn't really have constant, kind of a slow variation over larger time scale, over larger x scales. The same for the diffusion process. So actually we have it or here, or to be a little bit more careful, we put it inside. And we're not going to discuss it now here, but P of x, diffusion constant, by dx squared. So that is the Fokker-Planck equation. So just what I have to remember, it comes from the continuity equation. We have a transport due to drift velocity, and the gradient of this transport, and the transport due to diffusion. And therefore, here we have a second derivative. So we're going to do a few calculations with this Fokker-Planck equation, the simplest one. Now, of course, everything depends how things look like, especially how the force looks like, or the potential. And as usual in physics, we consider first the harmonic potential, quadratic. So sometimes the Fokker-Planck equation always considered a little bit mysterious or difficult. But if you remind yourself where these individual terms come from, it's actually pretty straightforward. It's very, very well-defined physics. So let's see what happens in an harmonic potential. So we consider V of x equals F half x squared. What that means just that F of x equals minus F times x. And we want a stationary solution. So that's what we're doing here. Of course, people can also look at the time development. It's also interesting. So d by dt, v of x and t equals 0. And that, of course, means that d by dx of the current of x and t is also 0. That means the current is everywhere constant. Now, if the current is everywhere constant, normally we can have two possibilities, really a constant current flowing, or we can set this constant current which is flowing to 0. And now, of course, we know that in a harmonic potential, we cannot have a constant current forever, because it would go up for infinity, it would need to go up to the harmonic potential, which is not possible. So we can set actually then the current to 0. J of x equals 0, since it's time independent also. So that means our current operator was do I still have it here, or did I? Yeah, here I have my current operator. That is a drift velocity. The drift velocity is the current. Yeah, it's written here. So I have fx divided by gamma m, plus q divided by 2 gamma squared m squared d by dx of p of x, in this case, equals 0. Because if you look at this, this was my drift velocity, my force. What do I have it? Negatively. Oh yeah, because I have changed my sign here. I would have a minus sign here, but I had a plus sign here. I changed that. And this is my diffusion process. So I have a very simple differential equation for my stationary probability distribution. So this is x, this is my v of x, and I will find some p of x stationary distribution. Of course, it will be maximal here, where the potential energy is smallest and larger otherwise. And the solution is very simple. Namely, the solution is that p of x equals some normalization constant times e to the minus beta I half x squared, not I f, sorry, f half x squared, which is some normalization constant e to the minus beta v of x, and where beta is the ratio of these two quantities. So if you write this equation taking out one of these quantities, to make it simpler, beta x plus d by dx of p of x equals 0 by just multiplying by all that stuff, then beta is what is left over. Beta equals 2 gamma m divided by q. Is that correct? There's some f missing maybe. Oh, no, the beta f. Sorry, I put a beta f. My force is explicit still. 1 gamma is getting out, 1 gamma q, 1 m is missing. Yeah. And so why is this a solution? Oh, that's really not difficult. We just take the first derivative, p prime equals a times minus beta f half times 2x e to the minus beta f half x squared. That is all I can take out. And if I take the second derivative, a I can take out. And then I see here I have, I can divide by that, and this is exactly x. So this is nothing else than minus beta f of p. Correct? Times x. And so these two terms cancel out. Correct, yeah. So the major result is, namely, that what I have is that p of x is a normalization A times e to the minus some beta f of x. Now this is of course a little bit of gemogelt, cheating, because we only actually found that this is proportional to the harmonic to an harmonic function. But well, we generalize it a little bit and say, and this is of course not an exact solution, But then we say, well, in this case, it's exact, of course. V of x is f half squared x squared. But we generalize it a bit and say, oh, this is probably true, approximatively true for all potentials which are not, well, somehow in the, of this form, confining form. But of course, this is not exact. Well, it is exact for the harmonic potential, but otherwise, it's a good approximation, which more or less gives you the right result. And so it tells you that, of course, the probability to find particles is highest where the potential is lowest. And beta is an effective temperature, inverse temperature. That's why we call it beta. It's, of course, given by microscopic parameters, which we know. And it goes exponentially down with the potential to find particles further out because, well, both the gradient and the frictions wants to turn it down, and only the stochastic motion makes it going out, pushes out. Beta was, where's my expression for beta? Yeah. So if Q goes to zero, means beta goes to infinity. If beta goes to infinity, means the temperature goes to zero. If the temperature goes to zero, everything is here. And if Q is very large, that means a small beta, then we have a spreading out. So Q is essentially like the temperature. Now, this is a very important insight for the following situation. What is denoted stochastic equation, stochastic escape? Well, what happens if the potential doesn't go to infinity, where infinities are rare in nature? So all harmonic potentials, mostly if you don't do quark, gluon, plasma, stuff like that, all harmonic potentials sometimes stop. So what happens if the potential looks something like that? That means we have a harmonic potential here, but it's not really an exact harmonic potential. It's some approximate harmonic close to the local minima. So we have an x min here. And that means if we look at the solution of the Fokker-Planck equation, there will probably be some p of x stationary like that. But then we see, oh, this cannot really be never an exact solution, never ever, because we know that this goes exponentially down. It goes exponentially down with this height difference, e to the minus beta, this difference. But even if it's exponentially down, it is never zero here. And if it's never zero there, that means I have a finite diffusion probability for the particles to go over the local minima, and once they are here, they will disappear in infinity. And even if this leak rate is small, it will continuously, the particle will leak out. And that is denoted stochastic escape. Why stochastic? Because both friction and the potential keeps the particle here, and only the random forces, which is denoted stochastic processes, can have a chance to kick the particle if they kick it many times. Every kick is small, but there can be a small probability that these kicks all go into the same direction and finally push it over. Of course, if the stochastic force is larger and we have something like that, Or actually, this is not normalized then, but anyhow, sorry. If our distribution function is something like that, then this probability is really large and the stochastic escape is very strong. We wouldn't even talk about that. So stochastic escape is happening if we are, this leak rate is very small. Like it, for example, happens in nuclei. So a proton is stable, but not very stable after how much? 10 minutes or something like that? It's decaying. How long is it if it's not in a nuclei? 1 minute or 10 minutes? Something. So if a proton is not bound in a nuclei, it decays after a while. And so we can make a small estimate when this happens. So for example here, the potential would be something like minus x plus x squared. It's a typical cubic potential, which has here a minimum and a maximum. But one could take another potential. And this the probability e to the minus beta delta v is the probability to find particles here, where delta v equals v of x max minus v of x min. Because that is what we calculated, is x min, and this is here x max. And then the current at that point will be proportional also. Actually, the drift current will be proportional to the gradient, but it's nevertheless still exponential, even if you have something outside. So the current will be proportional to the to e to the minus beta delta v, and that is the leak current or the escape current which this particle will escape. Leak or escape current. One can also do that a little bit more careful, which we don't do here, by looking here at the derivatives here and there, because the current is actually, as you know, the diffusion current is proportional to the gradient of the particle densities. And if you calculate all that in, then one defines the final, the probability to escape, the escape rate, so how many particles per time escape, so the Cramer's escape rate, and that is normally called the Cramer escape rate, is proportional to Rk, because it's a rate. It's an omega max times omega min divided by 2 pi gamma and e to the minus beta v of x max minus v of x min, where omegas are the second derivative of the potential here, so the gradient of the forces. So they are the second derivatives. So the omega min, for example, is the v2 prime at x min, actually divided by m, and omega max the same. So more careful estimate gives that. It's not the exact solution also, of course, because it really depends how exactly the potential is, but it's a somewhat better approximation taking account to the curvature there. We will come back to the stochastic escape when we talk about evolution. Of course, there's stochastic escape in many circumstances, in physics, for example, in nuclei, when nuclei radioactive decay, in many other instances. In evolution, we will have local fitness maxima. So a group of living being forming a species have all a fitness which we'll define, which are very closely connected, local to a fitness maxima. And the issue is how probable is that they all go away and go to another fitness maxima which might be higher. So normally in evolutionary processes, it's not really that any mutation or change in the genome will always give you a continuous increase in your fitness, in your in the probability for your descendants to survive. But it might be necessary that you first go down in your fitness before you can become substantially larger. And of course, this can be either in a one big step, because you do a substantial difference in your genome, or it can be with a few steps due to a stochastic process, and then you have stochastic escape. Which we will find it's actually pretty rare that this will happen in evolutionary processes. And the next step we will consider is something a little bit more subtle, but somehow related, and it's the concept of stochastic resonance, which is really pretty cute, because here in this process, the stronger the randomness, so the stronger the random kicking is, the larger the current. So the more randomness, the more current. But in stochastic resonance, you will find an incidence of a process where a very small amount of noise doesn't do anything, and a very large amount of noise also not. So whether the effect you might be able to observe depends on that the noise is not too big and not too small. So this is, of course, somehow intuitive, because normally you think, oh, noise is just the bigger, the worse, or whatever, the stronger the effect. But it's not necessarily the case. And that's why it's denoted stochastic resonance, because it's a resonance is always when something depends on the amplitude or on the frequency, on the driving force. So what we will consider is a double well potential, which is not constant in time. So the potential changes with time, V of x and t. And sometimes, so it's essentially double well, but sometimes this is a little bit higher, and this is a little bit lower, or the other way around. This is a little bit lower, and this is a little bit higher. So we have x dot equals minus v prime of x plus a zero cosinus omega t plus psi of t. I have to explain that. So if we look at our Langevin equation, it really doesn't look like the Langevin equation. So our Langevin equation was m v dot equals minus gamma m v minus v prime plus psi of t, psi. And if you look at the limit, that this term here is very small, so that these terms dominate. So essentially we say the mass is essentially zero. It always follows, but we have gamma times m is going to infinity, so gamma is going to a constant. So if the mass goes to zero, then we have here x dot, then we go to this equation here, because we just take it on the other side. So m going to zero, then we here we have x dot, which is here, and on the right-hand side we have essentially, so potential, if you have in the limit that gamma m equals 1. So we set the mass to 0, but gamma m to 1, and then we come to this equation. So that means friction is dominant, and stochasticity is dominant, and the mass is very small and always falls friction and the noise. And so our potential is like that. So we have a double well potential. V of x equals minus, let's say, 1/2 x squared plus 1/2 x to the fourth. That is a double well potential here. It is negative here and positive here, so it has two minima. I think at plus minus 1 are these ones. I think these ones are here at plus 1, and this one here is at minus 1. And to this double well potential, I add a linear force. I add a linear potential. Why is it a linear potential? Because that potential is a derivative. So the time-dependent potential is a zero cosinus omega t times x. If I take then, or minus x actually, if I take then the derivative, I come to the force. And so it means I have a double well potential, and which is symmetric, and I'm adding to that a small linear potential. But sometimes like that and sometimes like that. And by adding a linear potential, this one is sometimes lower and this is higher and vice versa. So this is the simplest case of a double well potential which is shifting in time sometimes. And now what happens? Now, we consider that a zero is small. Because if a zero is very big, we can make this one actually disappear, or even like that. So then all particles which had been here are forced to fall down. Now, we are not considering that, but only this situation. And so now what can happen? Well, we have the following, that these particles are here, they're up, they're not in the energetically lower state, but they can go only there via stochastic escape, so via Cramer's escape rate. Now, if they go there, the potential might have already changed, and this might have been higher or no. And so whether going there and forth and back makes energetically sense depends on the frequency, on which velocity are these changes happening, and on the velocities of the Cramer escape. So we have two timescales. The timescale of this changing here, so t proportional to 2 pi over omega. And we have a time scale which is proportional to the escape, 1 over Cramer escape. And always when you have two time scales in a system, you might have a large effect if these two time scales are similar or the same. And there might be a small effect if the two time scales are very different. That is what happens in resonance. If the frequency, outside frequency time scale, matches the frequency of the internal spontaneous oscillation, you have resonance and a big effect. And so this is internal here. Internal. Or, and this is external. Or the other way, if you, you could also consider this external, since this depends on the noise, and if you change the noise. So on the this depends how you think of the system. So you could either make the experiment that this is internal, and you change the frequency of the oscillation, or you can consider the other way around, which we will do. We can consider this one fixed and change this part. So what happens is that in this case, if you look at that, since the Cramer's escape rate R depends on the noise, the matching of these two velocities depends on Xi, so on the noise level. So if you look at the numerical simulations, so you can make now numerical simulations. And do the following. So you look, for example, as a function of time, where the particle is. And so you have two minima at minus 1, here's 0 and 1. And the particle will be maybe mostly sometimes at minus 1, or closely there, and then make a stochastic escape and go close to the other local minima and sometimes around. Now this will happen if xi is very small. Well, I'm putting 0, but this is not the exact. Now, if the noise is very large, you will have the other way around. If the noise is very large, it's better to do it like that here, minus 1 is plus 1. If the noise is very large, the potential really doesn't play a role. So you do plenty of stochastic escape because noise is very large. And now, in the intermediate case, you will find that the noise will be here, will make a stochastic escape, and here, and here, and here. And it will be more or less in locked with the frequency omega of the change in the potential. So if you have the noise level is right, not too big and not too small, then you will be most likely, not always of course, it's a stochastic process, to change intact with the frequency. Now in order to make that precise, you have to calculate a precise quantity to find what that is. So you can calculate a response quantity. And the response is So what you say is, well, the average amplitude is zero, of course, because you on the long time you always go forth and back, but you may have an amplitude which is proportional to some parameter x times cosinus omega t minus a phase shift. So that is if I have no response. So what does it actually mean? It means if I take the amplitude and I average over time also, I have zero averaging over time. But if I make a Fourier analysis of my trajectories, of all trajectories, and I make the Fourier analysis of all trajectories, and I do, of course, the ensemble average over over noise realization, I may find in my Fourier analysis a finite component, amplitude, with linking to the external or to the frequency omega of my change in the harmonic, potential. And that you can is a response function. Why is it a response? Now, x bar is a response of the system to whatever quantities you have. You might either consider a response to a zero, or if a zero is finite, a response to psi. So a zero given psi, or q, to say better, or to q given a zero. So either, depending how you do the experiments, you can either have your noise constant and change the amplitude of your harmonic change in the harmonic potential, or you have this one fixed and you change the strength of your noise. But this is the response. Why is it the response? Because the time average is zero, and if there's either of them is zero, there's no harmonic component. So that is a response function as we defined. And if you plot this response function, x bar, then you can exactly see how it looks like. For example, in our case, if we look at it as a function of q given a certain a0, then we find on the average something like that. That means it is very small. If q is equal to 0, it becomes small for large q, and it's maximal at a given q. So the response is maximal for a given noise. And that what is denoted stochastic resonance. A certain amount of noise is optimal to achieve this system. Now, this is actually happens pretty often. Why does it happen pretty often? Well, consider a system with a threshold. And you have a sub-threshold driving. So this is some function, for example, the membrane potential of a neuron. And if the main membrane potential goes above a certain threshold, something happens. For example, the neuron spikes. Something qualitatively happens. But below, you have a driving which is subcritical. It doesn't drive you above the threshold. So without noise, nothing happens. But if you have noise, then here nothing happens, but here the noise might be likely to drive you above the threshold. That means with noise, you might see periodic spiking. Without noise, not. And if the noise is too large, it's always above the threshold. You don't see any periodic spiking also. And these kind of processes occur actually pretty frequently, that you might have a sub-threshold driving a noise or other perturbations drive you outside. It must not necessarily be noise. It can also be something which just, since you don't know the causes, looks like noise. I mean, noise is everything which you don't understand. And it might be in the brain, there might be very cognitive processes which you just don't understand, so it looks like noise and it drives you sub-threshold, up above the threshold. Another famous example where actually this concept of stochastic resonance was developed was in climate research, a very famous example, still controversial, but probably true. That is a certain cycle, there are different cycles in the ice ages here on the northern hemisphere. So there are different cycles, quite a few different ones, and there's one cycle in the sun which changes the luminosity of the sun by a relatively small amount. So the because of some celestial mechanics, the Earth going forth and back and inclination, the luminosity changes on a time scale of about 100,000 years. But it's a small change. Nevertheless, in the ice ages, you see periodicity so if you look at the periodicity in the intermediate, so inter-ice age times, there are, of course, quite a few things you see, but you also see a pretty good sign of 100,000 years period. And so what one believes is that this is an unstable effect. There's a small change in the velocity of the sun is not really enough to drive the Earth from a state with and without ice. But due to other stochastic processes like volcano stuff and local climate stages and ocean circulation changes, together with all that noise, it might be able to drive it to the other state. So you have two states, one with ice and one with very little ice. Both are stable states. And if the sun changes, of course, this may be preferable to that one, but it's not enough to drive it. And both are stable locally, and local stability means it's a runaway effect. So if you have a lot of ice, ice is very reflective, so a lot of sun is reflected. So the albedo of the Earth is increasing because a lot of light is reflected directly to space. So temperature goes down because is not warmed up if the light is reflected. So once the ice starts growing, it grows because albedo increases and becomes lower. Of course, in normal times, it doesn't grow. The other effect, it doesn't grow completely. And the other way around, it's a run effect. If ice starts to shrink, more and more sun is absorbed here, and that's why the polar region heats up a lot, like nowadays. It's a runaway effect, and it goes becomes smaller. There have been actually times in Earth where this run effect will go through, I'm not sure whether you know about that, through the equators. That was snowball Earth. So about from 2.5 to about actually 500 million years ago, we had several periods of snowball Earth, where Earth was frozen down completely up to the equator. which actually happens only or mostly only if most of the continents are around the equator. This is actually extremely interesting. So there could be that Earth was frozen, maybe not exactly, but nearly to the equator. So maybe close to the equator, there was a little bit warm region for life, but essentially ice was going down to the equator. And of course, only the volcanoes have saved Earth. And this was in this day a few hundred million years ago, as million years. So it was not a short time like our ice ages. This snowball Earth was a few hundred million years long, substantial. And what then happened is that the volcanoes pumped out CO2, and over the course of a few hundred million years ago, CO2 would rise so dramatically that finally the snowball Earth was broken and the ice would smell because of the runaway climate effect. Until then, the CO2 was used up by the plants, and again, and the CO2 level would go down, and the new snowball effect, Earth, would come. Before that not, just as if you're interested in that, before that, snowball Earth didn't happen because the atmosphere of the Earth was probably mostly dominated not so much by oxygen, but by methane, CH4. Which is a very strong greenhouse gas. And the Earth was more looking like Titan, so it was not a blue sky, but a yellowish sky, and it was much warmer. And once there was a great oxidation effect, as oxygen level dramatically increases 2.5 billion years ago, and then Earth became blue, and the snowball effect started to happen. But volcanoes saved us, otherwise without volcanoes, of course, no life would be possible here on Earth. So anyhow, nowadays this doesn't really play a role. Only in the ice age it's a little small effect, not as big as at that time. Yeah, stop here. Yeah.